You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome. Well, welcome back to our program on this Tuesday. Oh, what a wild week. Last night in Boston, the police were in fine fettle, and so were the protesters. And the whole Occupy Boston movement is, you know, rolling right along. And Veterans for Peace seems to be the first people who were busted, showing up saying, you know, here we are, Veterans for Peace, and upwards of 100 people were arrested. So, you know, what's going on with that? We will be getting into that. A vote is expected on the jobs bill today. That's going on. The unemployment. Remember the deal that Obama made last year? Well, you know, please give us 1 year of unemployment extensions for 2 years of Bush tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. That's probably going to be voted on by the Senate tonight. So we will see how that plays out. We'll see what's going on with that. So anyway, lots going on. The Keystone XL pipeline, it looks like Obama's going to sign off on it now that his jobs czar, Jeffrey Immelt, the CEO of, it pains me to say it, General Electric, came out and endorsed it this morning. And although, you know, hope springs eternal. And is Brad on line one? Is that Brad? Okay. Brad Johnson is with us. Brad is a reporter and blogger with the Center for American Progress's thinkprogress.org blog based in Boston. Hey, Brad.
Hi. Good to be there.
Thank you. Great to have you with us. Tell us what's in real time right here. The headline I'm reading is Boston police throw American flag to ground, arrest veterans, trash property to protect, quote, green space, end quote, from 99%. This is the blog that you wrote for the Center for American Progress at 3 o'clock this morning. Really?
Yeah, well, this, to take it back to yesterday, or actually a week ago, Occupy Boston began in a park right in the heart of the financial district. And over the week, essentially, the number of people involved in Occupy Boston has grown. And so on Monday, they moved to expand and set up a new encampment, essentially a block away from the original park. And that's when the police started responding and saying, we don't want you there. And so by Monday afternoon, the police were warning. It was kind of interesting because they were using Twitter to communicate.
The police were?
Yes, the police were. It's Boston underscore police, if you want to follow them.
Follow their Twitter account.
and they were warning them that the park that the protesters had expanded to, had all these expensive new plantings that some very rich people had, paid to put on. And so they didn't want, that to get disrupted, even though they said that they respect, you know, the right of people to peaceably assemble.
Right.
And then starting at about, 1:30 in the morning, police started swarming the new encampment, and then moved in, gave the kind of the bullhorn, we're going to start arresting you. Veterans for Peace had shown up and were kind of leading front of the encampment, holding flags, including the American flag. And then the police just moved in and ended up arresting, I believe the official count now is 129 people, which makes it one of the biggest mass arrests in Boston, at least in 15 years, I believe.
I'm curious, here in D.C., for example, we have a couple of different parks being occupied by basically groups that are factionally different. I don't know, you know, without getting into a lot of details.
Right.
Is that what happened in Boston, or is this, you know, they just got too big for the group?
It's funny, a police spokesman who was talking to reporters afterwards claimed that this had to do with, this was this group of anarchists, and Fox News picked it up, and they're like, oh, you know, these are the anarchists. There's no indication of that there was any factionalism or anything. This was, I mean, you know, it is a kind of a leaderless movement, but this was, I mean, really all it was is that the space that they're in only fits maybe 100, 150 people.
Right.
And they, you know, and so they were just, and there's this long park that's separated by roads that stretches all along the heart of financial district. So they were just kind of expanding into the natural locations.
It'd be, did anybody offer to, for example, take up a donation to replace the shrubbery when all is said and done so that the rich people aren't offended and the park is back to normal?
Well, I can say that in the
not that I'm gung-ho in favor of not offending rich people, but you get my point.
Right. Well, in the original location, which didn't have the expensive plantings made and essentially just a lawn, they've worked out that they're going to work with the Greenway to resod it, you know, if and when the occupation ends.
Right.
But they weren't, the short answer is that they weren't ever given a chance to do that.
Oh, that's unfortunate. I think one of the things that Glenn Beck did so brilliantly when he did his gig here, when he had 70,000 people here on the Washington Mall, was he got everybody basically in advance, and he pitched this on his show and all that kind of thing. He got everybody in advance to basically say, we will pick up after ourselves. We will pick up our trash. And they did. I mean, you know, he emphasized that again from the rostrum, and the place was spotless when he left, or at least that's the lore, you know, that has
right.
been
yeah,
promulgated.
It's certainly one of the most important things that Tea Partiers hold to be true about themselves is that they don't ever litter, even though, you know,
well, it would be nice to push back on the kind of dirty hippie thing that has been promised. Speaking as an old hippie myself, this is not a slur, but that's how Fox is doing it, is, you know, these people, you know, they need a shower and they leave trash everywhere. And
it's really pretty amazing. If you go down to Occupy Boston, and any of your listeners or viewers who are in the Boston area, I mean, it's not that hard to go. It's right there at South Station.
Yeah.
It's really quite amazing what they've done. It's a really a kind of a beautiful thing to see professionally run. I mean, they are camping, so, you know, it does look like the inside of a hotel lobby. But there's, you know, they take cleanliness, sanitation, the space very seriously. They're doing this because they believe in the constitutional right to, you know, peaceably to assemble.
Right.
And to petition their government. They're not doing this for fun.
Right. No, clearly. Freezing 3 a.m., let's get arrested. That's not fun.
Right.
So, Brad, where's this going to go today? What are you hearing from the people there and beyond today?
I think what's going to happen is this evening there's going to be another general assembly. My understanding is that, you know, it's hard to tell when you see things on Twitter of, like, telling that people are all, like, getting on buses to come up to Boston, it's hard to tell how true that is.
Right.
I suspect that the assembly that takes place at Dewey Square Park this evening there's definitely people are contacting Mayor Menino, who said on Fox, or actually he was talking with NACN this morning, he said that even though he sympathizes with the concerns of the protesters, that civil disobedience will not be tolerated in Boston. That's where he draws the line.
Mm-hmm.
And so people have been contacting Mayor Menino. There's a bail fund that people have set up.
Is there any kind of permitting necessary to be in any of these parks? Has any of that been done?
I mean, I'm just like in Occupy Wall Street, like, you know, there are generally permits that are expected, but I don't think you can get a permit for a indefinite occupation.
I'm guessing you're right. Brad Johnson.
Go on.
We're out of time, Brad, but let me just refer people to you. Your great blog over at thinkprogress.org and your commentaries out there reporting on the ground from Boston about what's going on, reporter and blogger with Think Progress. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you.
Great talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Back with more about the Occupy Boston movement, what's going on with the American Jobs Act, and more. You're right up here.
We keep marching to the recall. We're going to get there soon. Won't be long. We're going to come 500,000 strong. We'll shake the shit. State House, halls and walls, when we come marching to the recall.
Let's see, which recall would that be? Oh, yeah, Scott Walker, amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and John Nichols on the line with us, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine and resident of the fine city of Madison, Wisconsin. John, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Tom. We've been a long journey to get here.
We have. Yeah. And tell us about what's going on right now in Wisconsin. And also, why isn't this happening, or is it, to what extent, in Ohio, Michigan,
sure.
Florida?
Well, you're asking exactly the right question, because we're getting toward this wonderful moment of renegade democracy, you know, not controlled by the powerful.
Right.
But actually driven by the people exactly as it should be.
Yeah.
And in some places, it's easier than others. In Wisconsin, because of a confluence of events, the groups that have been agitating for quite a while to remove Governor Scott Walker, the radical anti-labor governor who assaulted collective bargaining rights, the civil service, local democracy, provoking all the demonstrations of the spring, these groups have been organizing for a long time, looking for, you know, when's the right time to move, how to do this. And they have decided to begin the recall process on November 15th. That gives them 60 days to gather officially 540,000 signatures, in reality probably something closer to 700,000 signatures, aiming to force the governor into a special election sometime early next spring. Now, this is really the first moment at which it can happen. They're moving immediately rather than waiting along some political timeline. The reason for that is multifold, and it all comes back to things that your show is covering. Of course, it's rooted in the urgency of the Wisconsin experience. It's also rooted in the fact that this governor suddenly is in the midst of a corruption scandal. His chief political appointee's home was raided by the FBI. His press secretary has taken immunity in a John Doe investigation. His chief of staff just stepped down 2 days after it was revealed that that chief of staff had created a sort of a make-work position for the subject of the FBI investigation. A lot of stuff is coming around Walker. And then at the same time, and it can't be separated, Walker was really the first kind of heavy blow of these new Republican governors toward labor, toward basically middle class in this country, sort of really taking apart basic protections. And at the moment that the Occupy Wall Street movement has just kind of swept across this country and touched so many people, you see a real regeneration of the energy in Wisconsin. So all coming together, this recall drive is going to be huge. It will involve hundreds of thousands of people. 200,000 people have already pledged to participate. I want to underline that.
Wow.
200,000 people have pledged.
So if each one of them gets three signatures or four signatures, you're there.
Yeah, you're there. Yeah. And so you understand the dynamic that is in play.
Yeah.
This starts on November 15th. There are people who think, you know, that it's going to be hard to get 700,000 signatures. My sense is that it's going to move very, very rapidly.
I think this is going to go like the Senate Bill 5 thing, where they
in Ohio,
where they got 1.5 million signatures and they needed what, 600,000 or something.
No, they only needed about 300,000.
300,000. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think you're going to see a similar dynamic here. And you asked a really critical question: why isn't this happening in Michigan, in Ohio, in other places? Many states do not allow the recall and removal of errant elected officials. Sort of the great tragedies of our political experiment. Only the states that really had strong progressive traditions.
Right. Back when actually it was Republican progressives, like Bob Lafalette.
Great Republican Socialist Coalition that existed.
At the turn of the 19th century, or the beginning of the 20th century.
You're exactly right. And so, interestingly enough, Michigan does have a recall. And there is no doubt that the people who are fighting Governor Schneider in Michigan are watching what's happening in Wisconsin very closely. We actually border on our northern border with Michigan.
Sure, with the Upper Peninsula.
Great deal of communication going back and forth. I think there's a possibility there. Ohio does not allow for the recall, but it has the veto referendum, which this Senate Bill 5 you're going to see in play in November.
Right.
And so what I think the way to look at it, perhaps the best way to look at it, is that what's about to happen in Wisconsin and what is happening in Ohio, what you're seeing in different forms in different places across this country, is the right linkage of the Occupy Wall Street movements and all of these protest movements and agitations of this year with our politics. We ought not follow the schedule of the politicians. We ought not, you know, kind of live by their defined rules. If we're really going to make this a democracy, we ought to be in the streets, and then we ought to also be at the doors with our petitions, seeking to force elections on our schedule with an eye toward radically changing not just our economy, but our politics. Mm. And I really think that you're going to see an amazing process play out in Wisconsin, one that is far more intense than even presidential level politics, because it's forced on the politicians, not on their schedule. You're going to see immense amounts of spending. There's no question of that. The political class, particularly the Republicans, but even some Democrats, are scared by this. Mm. Governor Walker last week sought to take control of the State Government Accountability Board, which oversees elections. In a backroom maneuver, they pressured the board to back off rule changes and then actually threatened to put the governor in charge. Hasn't happened yet, but I think that's the kind of politics we're going to see. Incredibly intense stuff, brutal battle, no doubt about it, lots of money. But when you've got 200,000 people saying they're ready to go on the march, yeah, something big is happening.
This being statewide, I know that, you know, you didn't win all the Senate seats that you were looking for. Some of those are in fairly rural areas. Is this being statewide very quickly going to work to the advantage or disadvantage of the movement?
Advantage, totally.
To the advantage.
Nine state Senate districts all voted for Walker in 2010. This right. brings in places like Madison and Milwaukee, which have immense numbers of people who are not fans of the governor.
There you go. John Nichols, one of the finest political minds in America, writing for The Nation, thenation.com. Thank you, John.
Thanks, brother. It's going to be a year.
Good indeed. Good speaking with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, a veteran for peace from Boston is going to be joining us. He was roughed up by the Boston police last night. Real interesting story. Stick around. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And John Niles is on the line with us. John is a member of the American Veterans for Peace. The website, of course, veteransforpeace.org. And John, in Boston, in fact. And John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for talking to us, Tom. I enjoy your program immensely.
Thank you. It's an honor to have you on. John, tell us what happened yesterday. You were there.
Well, I belong to the Boston chapter, which is named for the Marine Major General Smedley Butler, War as a Racket.
Who refused to lead a coup against Franklin Roosevelt when the banksters asked him to.
Absolutely. You've got it down, and I totally recommend a new biography on him. It's just called Devil Dog.
Uh-huh.
And the subtitle is The Amazing Story, True Story of the Man Who Saved America, which alludes to the attempted coup d'etat. That's how he saved America.
Yeah.
And we scared him off, or at least he scared him off till 1963.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So what happened to you last night?
Excuse me? We were having a normal meeting, monthly meeting, and we got a text. We had some people from Occupy Boston at the meeting. And they got a text that the cops were about to move on the display on the Occupy Boston. So we immediately adjourned our meeting and jumped on the T and headed down to Dewey
Square. We being the Veterans for Peace group?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
And when we arrived, there was nothing much going. The crowd had grown too much to be contained by Dewey Square, and we're on the next adjacent piece of property on the Rose Kennedy Greenway. Mm-hmm. And we had our flags, and we got a tremendous reception by the people, and not much was happening, and they were regular uniform Boston police, you know, all over the place, and they were engaging with some of the people were talking to them, and we were kind of thinking nothing was going to happen until we saw a gathering of the black-shirted, jack-booted robocop types that were lining up on one end of the property.
Yeah, we call them the mutant ninja turtles.
Whatever. I mean, but the thing is that we, veterans for peace, all linked arms, probably more than symbolic, Tom, because some of us, especially the Vietnam guys, are getting a little long on the tooth, but we, at least symbolically, we're going to form a line of resistance against the Gestapo, you know, on behalf of the regular people.
Yeah.
And they announced that we had 10 minutes to clear the area. We just stood fast, and then they came running. The gentleman next to me was Pat Scanlon, who is a dear friend and coordinator of the group and also a Vietnam veteran. And next to him was a young, beautiful young Iraq vet lady, Rachel O'Neill. And they were perhaps the most vociferous in the chants we were, you know, we were repeating the oath that we took to uphold and support the Constitution of the U.S. against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
Right.
And, you know, we have a permit. It's called the Constitution. And both Pat and Rachel were sort of leading the chants, and they zeroed right in on them, and they grabbed young Rachel and really manhandled her. And then Pat, my friend, went sort of to reach for her, and they grabbed him and hustled him away. And then two of them grabbed me. And one by the arm and one from my one by the Veterans for Peace sweatshirt that I was wearing, and just the looks in their eyes, they really seemed to enjoy the work. And so I pulled away from them, and at that point I got hit from behind, and I found out later that was a cop that had gotten around and back. And then one of them hit me across the shin below the knee with a baton, and another one hit me in the mouth with like an elbow check, knocked out a filling and knocked me to the ground. And then the whole wave of cops swept over me, and I guess they were intent on other people, and I didn't seem to be much of a threat on the ground, so I found a way to crawl away and basically escape to nurse my wounds.
Wow.
We hung out there for about another hour, seeing what the fate, in addition to Pat and Rachel, there were two other, young Iraq vet who, his name escapes me right now, and, another gentleman, Dave something or other, who is a fairly new member. We know they were arrested, and as of yet, nobody can find out where they are, including our attorney.
Okay. So but the arrests were not limited to the veteransforpeace.org folks, John Niles, you and your compatriots who showed up. The arrests were there were also people there from the other Occupy Boston
yes, that
park.
That's correct.
I guess
I
it
would
is.
Say they, according to the local mainstream media, you know, who can be taken with a 100-pound grain of salt over their heads.
Sure.
Approximately 100 were arrested.
Right.
And we were only probably, you know, 5% of it.
Okay. John, thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you, Tom, for all the fighting the good fight, my friend.
Okay, you got it. We're going to continue it. And please give my very best regards to everybody at Veterans for Peace there in Boston and Occupy Boston and everybody else. Tell them I said hi, okay?
We have just begun to fight, Tom.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you, John. This is the beginning, not the end. Thank you very much. Good talking with you.
Thank you, Tom.
Appreciate it. Liz Pelley was also there. She's a reporter embedded at Occupy Boston with thephoenix.com. Is the Phoenix what used to be referred to as an underground paper, the weekly paper in Boston?
It did. The weekly paper is part of our history, but now we're the Boston Phoenix.
I beg your pardon?
That was part of our history, but I work for the Boston Phoenix now.
Okay. And the Boston Phoenix is what?
The Boston Phoenix is an all-weekly newspaper.
Okay, yeah, okay. So it's an all-week. It's 5 days, 7 days a week.
No, all weekly.
Once a week.
Once
okay,
a week.
Great. Liz, what happened last night?
So the majority of my time spent there last night, I started covering the reporter, but it's been hard to watch without getting involved in the protests themselves. Mm-hmm. I spent most of the night linking arms with protesters on the original camp. There's one main camp in Dewey Square that's been occupied for over a week. This is the second week now. And yesterday there was a big student protest and march with like thousands strong. And coming back from that march, protesters decided that it was time to expand and occupy another second camp, which is like right down the block on the same greenway. And they got word from the police that if we didn't leave that second camp, that the police were going to come in and force everyone out. At the General Assembly that took place on the new camp, they decided to stay there anyway, that we were going to, everyone was going to push the tents together and encircle them, so everyone was linked arm in arm encircling that camp. But I personally was at the main camp because they had 200 people surrounding the camp, the second camp, and they had 325 estimated people at the main camp, which is the one that's been set up for weeks.
Right, at Dewey Square.
Yeah, in Dewey Square. So I was over there, linked arm in arm with other protesters, basically just, we had people running back and forth from the other camp to our camp, updating us, because there was a lot of, they didn't say directly that they were going to break up the camp at Dewey Square, but we had no idea whether or not they would. And that was like a very valuable camp to occupy Boston. So we didn't want to risk anyone coming and bringing that up. And that's where the media tent was as well, which was really a valuable resource. And if the police would have come in and destroyed that, that would have been a huge issue. But yeah, I mean, I also talked to some of the people who were at the second camp later after all the arrests were made, and it sounds like there was a lot of people being pushed to the ground. And
we're getting those firsthand reports. So, at the Dewey Square camp, that's ongoing. That was not attacked by the police last night, and will continue.
Yeah, that will continue. There's going to be a General Assembly there tonight, 7,
mm-hmm.
to follow up.
Okay. What, has there been, in the minute we have left here, Liz, there been any movement toward coming up with a list of, here's what, of demands, as it were, or is there still a consensus that, we're the 99% and we're here until there's change, and, the change... it could take a 100 different forms, and they're all fairly obvious.
I know that I'm not sure if, since yesterday or there have been any new demands posted, but there are definitely minutes from the General Assemblies on the Occupy Boston website that go more into the specific demands of people in Boston. I know there was a lot of talk of when they were trying to decide whether or not to ratify the document, the Declaration of Occupation from New York, that there were more specific needs of the Boston community as opposed to other ones, and those more information about those meetings could be found on the Occupy Boston website.
Okay, great. And I'm assuming the phoenix.com?
The phoenix.com/OccupyBoston is the hub where all of our content and all of our reports are going, and we'll have a ton more stuff there throughout.
Liz Pelley, thank you so much, Liz.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, 45 minutes past the hour. Balance. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's pick up some of your calls and thoughts. Liz in Brookville, Ohio. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Oh, Tom, this is a great day. I'm watching Free Speech TV, and I'm so energized by this crowd, and it suddenly dawned on me that corporate America has gone international, and these concerns that these people that we're having here in the United States coincides with what's going on around the world. This is a people's movement, and we are a people's party.
You're absolutely right, Liz. Thank you. Thank you so much for the call. You said it so well. And here's the simple reality of that. Is, and Matt Taibbi did the first really in-depth, brilliant reporting on this. Greg Palast did some brilliant reporting on it as well. Goldman Sachs sold the governments, well, actually, they conspired illegally with the government of Greece to hide Greece's debt levels that got Greece into the euro in the first place. And then they sold all these European countries this exploding, these exploding CDOs, CDSs, whatever, you know, these various securities. And when they blew up, it took down Europe. And it's still taking down Europe. And it's like, why doesn't anybody talk about that? I don't get it. You know, states say, oh, you know, our pension fund is a disaster. Well, why is your pension fund a disaster? Because Goldman Sachs and those other companies on Wall Street sold you exploding investments back in 2000. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then they blew up in 2008. They really started blowing up in 2004. I mean, if you really want to go back to it, that's really when it began. Sarah in Oakland, listening on KKGN, Green 960. Hey, Sarah, what's up?
Well, this is the occupation that I want to talk about. Is the one you won't see about anything in the newspaper because we started yesterday. There's been work, you know, to get it ready. Mm-hmm. Mostly right now we're just forming community, and I didn't see any cops. I didn't see anybody that made me uncomfortable. We were just there.
You're occupying Oakland?
Starting to have the community talk about what we can do. There will be skill shares. There'll be all kinds of stuff going in there, and it was a marvelous multicultural experience. Had some great conversations with some Africans who are living here. It was wonderful, and we all just...
That's great. Sarah, where is it?
We were a community, and we were friends.
For those people who are listening to us on Green 960 in San Francisco, in the Oakland area, where is it? How do they get there?
I don't know who was doing the infrastructure stuff, but it's on Ogawa Plaza, which is right where the center of the government buildings are. And it's near the Civic Center and has a major BART, which is our subway system, goes right there, easy
okay.
to get to.
Great. And the BART station is?
It's where people get out of the subway.
Okay. Yeah, I thought there was a name for them like there is in D.C. I'm sorry.
Bay Area Rapid Transit.
Right. Yeah. No, I got it. Thank you very much, Sarah.
A lot of people doing the 99 and 1%.
There you go.
You know, that whole theme is very, very strong. Also, we've had some individual discussions of everything from mountaintop removal to anything you can think of.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of issues on the table. Sarah, thank you for the call, and thanks for the heads up. Robert in Columbia, Maryland. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I just want to give you guys an update from Occupy D.C. I was out there Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to say congratulations to Freedom Plaza for getting an extension.
Yeah. And McPherson Square for still being there.
Yeah.
And for having been there for months and months and months.
We're going very strong over there. We've gone from 30 people up to 100 people sleeping in the park.
Yeah.
And swelling up to over 500 people during the day,
yeah,
coming to our GAs, and it's really incredible. And
that's
it's
great.
Very, very organized.
Okay. So a quick update, awesome. Robert. I want to get some more calls in here, and we've got about 2 minutes left.
I'll be sending in some video of the Air and Space. I got some really good video of Patrick Howley.
Okay, great. Yeah, let us know about that. Robert, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. John in Clinton Township, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Hey, appreciate you taking my call. I'd like people out there to try to buy more American products and create more jobs that way. I think we got to start being more patriotic and supporting our own country.
Well, let's start having government policies that make it easier to buy American products. For example, if, you know, in 1935, Franklin Roosevelt got passed the American Jobs Act. Excuse me, the Buy American Act. And the Buy American Act is still on the books. Ronald Reagan basically stopped enforcing it. But the Buy American Act says that any federal government agency, which represents a little less than 20% of the total GDP of this country. Any federal government agency that buys anything has to first source it from an American source. And if that was aggressively enforced, and federal government agencies started putting out requests for proposals saying, we're looking to buy computers, but they have to be made in America. We're looking to buy desks, but they have to be made in America. We want to buy chairs, but they have to be made in America. And we're looking to, fill in the blank, has to be made in America. Suddenly, you would see manufacturers starting to pop up in very, very significant ways. Jim in Las Vegas, Nevada. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hey, I'm a representative of Occupy Las Vegas.
Uh-huh.
And we had a protest. We met at New York, New York, on the strip at the Statue of Liberty on Thursday, and we were expecting between 400 and 500 people, and 1,100 people showed up.
Wow.
On the Strip of Las Vegas, we marched from New York, New York to the Bellagio and back around to MGM Grand. Not one person was arrested. Not one person had a medical problem, no accidents, no fights.
That's great.
The Metro Police Department was absolutely super. They wanted to be with us. They're part of the 99ers. A couple of them had told me their houses had been foreclosed on.
Yep.
One of the officers' wives got laid off from her teaching job. But I have called my Senator Harry Reid, my other Republican Senator Dean Heller's office. We wrote letters to them. We talked to them, both our Congress.
Good on you. Jim, we're flat out of time, but good on you for contacting people and for doing it. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And just an FYI, on Wednesday, tomorrow night, it'll be the battle of the talk show hosts, David Strode and I, against 8 conservatives, if I have my numbers right, in Denver. And then on Friday night, I'll be on HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher this Friday. So be there or be square. Welcome back to the program, to the second hour of our program. Right now, Professor David Vellone is with us. He's an associate professor at the Regent University School of Law. Regent University, regent.edu, Regent University, I believe, is the school that Jerry Falwell founded, isn't it, Professor?
Pat Robertson.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I mix up my evangelical leaders. So Pat's still around, actually.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, you are taking the position, and I don't understand this, that it was just a fine thing to assassinate Anwar al-Awlaki, an American citizen, without recourse to any kind of due process. And to my best recollection, in fact, let me get the exact language. The Fifth Amendment, nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property. This is certainly depriving of life without due process of law.
Right. Well, I think the real question that you've got to ask yourself in that situation, first of all, I don't like to use the term assassination when this individual was clearly an enemy combatant, a belligerent, and therefore
he was not carrying weapons.
Well, he was involved operationally with al-Qaeda. He, according to the administration, the Obama administration, he's a terrorist recruiter, as we know, actively plotting against the administration.
But al-Qaeda is not a country.
Well, that's correct.
So how do you declare war against not a country? I mean, the Brits had this problem with the Irish Republican Army. They never declared war against the IRA. They arrested people. The Italians had a problem with the Red Brigades. They arrested people. The Red Brigades even killed their prime minister, Aldo Moro. The Germans had a problem with the Bader-Meinhof gang. They arrested people.
Well,
you know, what's wrong with using due process against criminals? I mean, Tim McVeigh, he was part of a large movement, committed a horrible terrorist act. We arrested him, put him to death, but we gave him due process.
Well, again, what type of due process is due when you're talking about someone who, one, under the authorization for the use of military force, which Congress passed, gave our executive the authority to determine people in this situation are in fact belligerents, as well as under international armed. The law of international armed conflict, which allows for an individual who has taken up arms in hostility against a country to be treated as a combatant. And that's what I believe has gone on in this particular situation.
So you believe the authorization to use force to be constitutional, even though it wasn't a declaration of war?
I do.
I'm sure you're aware that Jefferson, Madison, most of the founders would be horrified by that statement.
Well, I believe that to call it what was authorized was that the president was authorized to use armed conflict in this war against these terrorists.
But the reason why in the Constitution Congress can only appropriate money for military action for a maximum of 2 years, and military action is the only thing that is limited, where Congress is limited in how long they can appropriate money for, was precisely because the founders were concerned about our getting involved in unending wars or on and on. I mean, this was the essence of George Washington's farewell address, as you'll recall.
I have no question that there is a balance that the Constitution lays out, and no question that that's exactly what Congress was attempting to do with regard to allowing Congress to have the purse strings. But at the same time, the executive, as the commander-in-chief and as the one most able to fight the wars, is given authority at times by Congress to go forward. And I think that's exactly what the authorization was.
But this wasn't just to go forward. This was, you are judge, jury, and executioner, and we set up a
only
three...
Only when somebody takes up arms. Only if someone takes up arms and is engaged in hostilities against this country, which is exactly what this terrorist was involved in this particular case. I mean, let's think about it. The question is what due processes do? He's part of an enemy force. He's a belligerent under the auspices of the AUMF. He's been on
he's a member of a criminal force. My personal take on it is that Al Qaeda is a criminal organization, not an enemy organization. That we're not, much like the IRA and the Bader-Meinhof gang and on and on. And for that matter, the militia movement that Tim McVeigh was part of. But here's the question.
Well,
why not simply hold a trial in absentia, find him guilty, convict him, and sentence him to the death penalty, and then authorize the military to assassinate him?
Because it is not necessary. This is not a judicial process question. This is a question of we're engaged in an armed conflict in a war that's unlike any war that we've been engaged in before.
No, it's totally Orwellian. That's how there is no declaration of war. Congress has not declared war.
Again, whether there's a declaration of war or not, this individual has in fact taken up arms against us, and in self-defense, I use the AUMF as one justification, which I believe is a good one. The other is, of course, that we are allowed to defend ourselves. And if this individual is engaged as an enemy combatant against us, then under international
law... He attacked us with rhetoric. Do you think that Tokyo Rose, for example, had a declared war in World War II, so that's a bad example. Do you think that, for example, when the Saudi Arabian government distributes books to other countries saying that, that Jews use the blood of Muslims for their ceremonies, and therefore they should be attacked everywhere, including the United States, that we should be attacking the Saudi royal family?
Tom, that's not enough. I agree 100% that that's not enough. And I also agree, in my opinion, the administration ought to publicly disclose some of their basis for making the decision that they made, because all of us, you, me, Congress, could more closely scrutinize the rationale and reasoning that they used.
Well, then it sounds like you're agreeing with me, Professor Filoni, because here's my concern. I mean, and Ron Paul articulated this very well the other day. Once we start going down this road of taking the judiciary out of the equation as it was put in by the Constitution and giving the power to assassinate American citizens solely to the President of the United States, the decision-making power solely to the executive branch, when is it going to be that the executive branch feels so under siege that they decide that you or me are going to be the next person assassinated?
Well, there is such a thing as executive due process, and we give certain responsibilities to the executive. I do not think that
due process in the Fifth Amendment does not envision the executive, and you know that.
Well, the judiciary is in no position to be able to evaluate whether or not someone is in fact a member of an armed force and to go through the targeting process.
Of course, you don't believe in our judiciary?
I believe very much in the judiciary.
You have no faith in their ability to determine. I mean,
well, I think, Tom, it really does come down to exactly what you said before. I think of this as not some law, global police action against some dangerous form of the mafia, which is what you appear to be looking at these terrorists as. I look at this as an actual armed conflict. And when we're in armed conflict, then the law of war applies differently than the way that you would have it applied.
But wars are held against nations, not against organizations. You don't declare war on the Communist Party of Italy and then start bombing the suburbs of Verona.
When an organization takes up arms and becomes a hostile force against the United States, I believe that we are then in an armed conflict, and as such, the president or the executive, those that Congress has specifically authorized, have the ability to.
Do you think during the 60s that when the Weather Underground was blowing things up, that the president should have had the authority to order the assassination of those people?
I think that, and I'm sorry because I missed your question there.
Oh, okay. Well,
I apologize.
Well, I'll say it again very quickly, but you'll have to answer it right after the break. Do you think during the 60s, when the Weather Underground was blowing things up and killing people, that the president should have ordered the execution of individuals?
No, I do not. I believe that that was a criminal action within the United States.
Okay.
This is a foreign force, and this is an armed conflict.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Sorry, I can't stop that voice from coming in. Dr. David Filoni, Regent.edu. Thanks for being with us, Professor.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Good talking with you. 15 minutes past the hour.
The Kochs would like to buy the world and make it all their own. It's grown too full of free ideas to really feel like home. Let's focus on the simple things like lower tax for all, and hope no one notices where the greatest benefit will fall. Yes, we finance the Tea Party and talking heads you'll trust, and hope the working folks don't see it helps out mostly us. We're the real thing.
That would be the KOCH. Welcome back. And I am honored to welcome back to our program one of the most brilliant documentarians in the United States, activist, filmmaker, and founder of Brave New Films, bravenewfilms.org, Robert Greenwald. Robert, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. It's wonderful to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. I understand you have a new project.
Yes, we have a new investigative video that we launched this morning, Koch Brothers, part of our Koch Brothers Exposed. And this particular one is the result of over 3 months of work by Jeff and Natalie and Joseph. They really dug in and found this small community in Arkansas, small African-American poor community, that literally, not figuratively, literally the people are dying and have died of cancer as a direct result of the Koch's Georgia-Pacific plant, which is spewing stuff into the environment, into the streams. And it's a heartbreaking story, Tom, and what we try to do is, you of course know better than almost anyone, we try to put a personal face on policy, because, you know, all too often these debates become abstract and they become seemingly unconnected to people's lives. Well, here we have people who are literally paying a price with cancer because of the ideology, the greed, and the money corruption of the Koch brothers.
Amazing. I get the Republican talking points every day, as most talk show hosts do.
My condolences.
I can predict every morning what Sean Hannity's going to say on his show, almost word for word. And the one that I got yesterday, the top talking point was regulations are prevent excessive government regulations are preventing job creators from creating more jobs, and I'm wondering if there might be a connection between that Republican talking point, which has become so pervasive that I can't put a conservative on this show without them quoting it almost verbatim over and over and over again, been so for about 5 months now, I would say, between that and the efforts of the Koch brothers, whose companies, if the EPA were to get a little more aggressive, might not be, according to your investigation, causing the death of people downwind in Georgia. Or well, Alabama, think, wherever that was.
Arkansas.
Thank you.
I think that's exactly right. I think that the Kochs ideology serves their profit motive, which is no regulations, or I prefer to call them no protections for people, and therefore allowing their capitalism to run wild and to take advantage of people, to take advantage of people who don't have the money, don't have the power, and don't have the access. And talking about the jobs in the abstract allows the right wing to really take the issue away. But as we're seeing with the Occupy folks right now, the Kochs are the 1%. These are the 1% who are controlling, distorting our democracy, and using their money in the worst way to buy off politicians and to weaken any kind of protection for people.
Yeah. And so we're talking with Robert Greenwald, the filmmaker, political activist, founder of Brave New Films. Is it bravenewfilms.org? Is that where people should go to see the Koch brothers exposed, or do you have a separate website for it?
Yeah, we have a website, kochbrothersexposed.com. We also have a Facebook page, and also you can follow me on Twitter, where we're posting the most recent investigations and articles and all kinds of things that come about as a result of what we're finding. And, you know, these investigations, Tom, take a lot of time and energy, but now we look to you and the listeners and the viewers to help us spread the word.
Yeah, and support your efforts. Let me put that plug in. You're humble or gracious enough not to to say that, but I will right up front that people should not only watch what you're doing, but support it financially, bravenewfilms.org. And I'm curious, Robert, I have said things on the air about the Koch brothers and gotten emails from either David or Charles, I forget which one, personal secretary, saying that fact was wrong. Here's the correct fact. And the first time it happened, I was like, whoa, what's this? I'm wondering if you've heard, as a result of your investigation of the Koch brothers, if you've heard from them.
Well, we've heard from them when we did our previous pieces. We did the piece on showing how they were literally, not figuratively, resegregating schools as a result of their ideological campaign. We heard from them on our Social Security video. I'm sure we'll be hearing from them here, and they've threatened their bullies. They say they're going to take legal action on the resegregation video. I don't know if you got one of those letters where they were saying, if you even talk about this, we're going to turn it over to our lawyers. But of course it was all bluff, because they may not be aware of this, but there are some free speech protections that exist in this country, and there are some folks like yourself and others who can't be bought off. And I'm sure they will threaten us, I'm sure they will be furious, because again, they try to pretend that this libertarian ideology and that this profit motive is just doing some kind of general good. But here you see people, they're coughing, they have respirators, and they are saying, the Kochs are killing me. The Kochs, our Georgia-Pacific plant is helping take away my life. And that's, as I think, as powerful and as strong as it gets. And it's also what I'm proud of, that, again, the folks, the amazing, brilliant staff at Brave New Foundation is able to do this research and show people a human face, because it's the human faces that ultimately move us to take the most action.
There you go. Absolutely. So well said. Robert Greenwald, bravenewfilms.org, and Koch Brother, K-O-C-H, Brothers Exposed dot, what is it?
.com.
Thank you, Robert.
Thanks
so much for being with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, I got to tell you what George is thinking about doing with free prison labor, and we'll be picking up your calls. 27 minutes past. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us, those of us left. Actually, there's a lot growing on the left. Welcome back. Harry in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Harry, what's on your mind?
Tom, great to speak with you again. I'm an organizer for Occupy Providence, and I purchased the two websites, .com and .org. And I'd like to talk with you about long-term strategy. here in Providence, we have a lot of young people in their 20s involved in the movement, and I've met with them. They have the direct democracy at their General Assembly that a lot of the others also have. But the reality is that labor, teachers, nurses, people of faith that we also want in this movement, a lot of them don't have the time that's needed to deal with a General Assembly that takes many hours to do major issues.
Right.
And so I'd like to set up one site for the faith community and the other so that labor, teachers, nurses, and so on can have a site where they can put down what their events and their issues are so people can become more informed. I'd like to know your view long-term of, you know, how can we involve more of the 99% in the movement and yet keep this Democratic General Assembly going?
Well, let me share a couple of thoughts with you then, Harry. First of all, I congratulate you on grabbing those URLs and publicly acknowledging that they're yours. And I think one of the things that is causing some hesitation on the part of some, you know, local teachers' unions or whatever, you know, whatever it may be, natural allies to not jump on board with organizations is that when you go to the About Us page, there's no there's no specific, hey, I'm the person, or here's the address, or here's our balance sheet, or here's we're going to be transparent about our finances. And in some cases, you go to Whois, you know, whois.com, and you do a Whois lookup, and you find out that they've even blocked, you know, who the person is who's registered the domain. And then there are other, there are, you know, some organizations that are, you know, basically run by a local activist, and you know, you, and what I'm seeing is a repeat of, frankly, what I saw in the 60s, which is that people start competing with each other. It's like in a small pond, frogs fight. And it's like people start competing with each other for that. And I think that the solution to that always is transparency. And that's where SDS ended up having to be, is completely transparent and completely democratic in the elections. And there is a, as much as people hold to the anarchist ideal, and I mean anarchist not in the sense of chaos, but in the classical political definition of anarchist, which is all people are equal and governance is the function of all, everybody having a voice. As much as they hold to that, what happens very often, or at least again, what I saw happen, you know, years and years ago, and I think I'm seeing repeat itself, is that in some cases, the person who has the microphone, or the person who has, the person who is, quote, leading the, or facilitating would generally be the word, ends up actually being a de facto leader. And then you see things devolve into loudly asserting that they're not. And then you see things devolve into these you know, angry frog fights. And so, in my opinion, if this movement is going to work, if it's going to grow, if it's going to attract a broader audience, and if it's going to actually produce the kind of change in America that it needs to produce, that needs to happen, it needs to be completely transparent. We need to know, you know, who the people are who are involved, what they're up to, what their agendas are, where the money's going, and there's, you know, and frankly, that's my problem with the Tea Party. You know, it was funded by the Koch brothers and Dick Armey, and all, everything is a black box, and there's no transparency. And so I would submit to you that the extent to which you, if you're starting this thing, can make it completely transparent is the extent to which, over the long term, it will survive. And you know, even if you were to say, oh, and by the way, I intend to, you know, as webmaster and as the guy who's going to devote his next year to this, you know, I hope to make a $10,000 income from it over the course of the next year, and that part of the, you know, proceeds are going to go for that. At least say it, you know. And you know, whatever that may be, and then I think things will work. On the other hand, if it devolves into a bunch of groups that are hiding behind anonymity and taking contributions, and you really have no idea where those contributions are going, and then you end up with dueling factions, it's going to it will frankly disintegrate. And in the meantime, the right-wingers will jump on, oh, we've figured out who this faction is, and look at that, and these people are that, and this, and then it'll get delegitimized. And that's one of the things that, frankly, I think is a concern within the movement, you know, from some of the folks that I've talked with.
Any word you have on how to get nurses, teachers, and their associations involved?
Call them. Call them. Call, you know, the local unions. Unions are democratic organizations. They are largely completely transparent. You can contact them. You can look them up in the phone book. Call them up. Tell them what you're doing. Say that you'd like to talk with one of the officers in the teachers' organization, or what, you know, fill in the blank for the name of the union or the organization. And you know, here's what you're doing, and how can we work together? You know, and
that's my plan, and I hope they respond. And I thank you for that.
Sure.
Great word on transparency, Tom.
It's critical, Harry. It's absolutely critical, because when you don't have transparency, whether it's the Tea Party or whether it's the Occupy, various 99% movements, or anything else, when you don't have transparency and you're trying to be a movement and you're trying to attract people to that movement, and you're asking them particularly to donate money or time or their life's energy, if you lack transparency, very quickly there will be a lack of trust. And that's the killer. That's the program killer. So, Harry, good luck. I wish you the very best. Thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Let's see here. Randall in Splendora, Texas. Hey, Randall, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment on government regulation inhibiting corporations' ability to hire new people, as you hear all the time, you know.
This is the Republican mantra, yeah. It's,
yeah,
it's nonsense.
Perfectly reasonable, you know, until you think, you know, in order to make that, you've got to assume that corporations exist for the purpose of creating jobs in the first place.
Right, and they don't. They exist for the purpose of creating value for their stockholders.
Right, exactly. I think that if the government were to hand them $1 billion, you know, they would just take that. That would be considered profit for the year.
It's already happened.
Get big bonuses, and they wouldn't hire anybody.
We gave hundreds of billions of dollars to Citibank, and what did they do? They laid off workers.
Yeah.
and gave their CEOs big bonuses. I mean, and not just that bank. So yeah, it's happened over and over and over again. And we need to be pushing back on that meme. I thought that. Robert Greenwald gave me just this brilliant moment of insight when he said, I call regulations protections. And the next time I debate a right-winger about regulations, I'm going to start throwing back the word protection at them instead of using the word regulation every time. Because consumer protections. Because that's what most regulations are, they're consumer protections. Now, there are some regulations that corporations actually lobby for. For example, in my book on equal protection, I document how in the early GMO days, Monsanto was in the Herbert Walker Bush administration aggressively lobbying for regulations so that they could basically lock down the business and keep competitors out. And those kind of regulations that create corporate monopolies are typically the ones that the anti-regulation people will point to, and they'll say, well, don't you agree with me on that? And I have to say, yeah, but that's not the kind of regulation that when the Republicans say, let's get rid of regulations, they're talking about. Those are the kind of regulations they want to keep. The kind of regulations that they want to get rid of are the ones that protect our kids from you know, arsenic in the water and mercury in the air and that kind of thing. So, Randall, excellent point. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Tim in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's up? Tim, you're on the air. Tim is not on the air. Okay. Al in San Francisco. Hey, Al, what's up?
Hi, good morning, Tom. I'm going to go a little bit off topic, and I wanted to talk about the boycott and Christmas thing that everyone was talking about yesterday.
Sure.
I'm a small store owner here in San Francisco, and that kind of talk absolutely terrifies me because, like me and a lot of my small mom-and-pop shop friends, we count on Christmas to get us through the really rough months. And
sure. Let's have an agreement then that the spirit of Christmas is to buy local, is to buy from small producers rather than large giant ones, and is to embrace community and family.
I think that's great. Thank you so much, Tom.
Okay, you're welcome, and very well said, Al. Thank you very much. You make such a great point, and it's an important one to make. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Armin, you got a minute to the break. What's up? It's all yours.
Quickly, supposedly Holder was going to go after Wall Street with Obama's blessings and exploit politically to Obama's election advantage.
I wish he would.
Protest, and he's been told that if he goes anywhere near it, that they're going to do the Fast and Furious scandal of arms going to the Mexican drug gangs.
Oh, he's been told that by Daryl Issa, you mean?
Pardon?
He's been told that by Daryl Issa?
The powers that be.
Yeah.
And then let me say one other thing real quick here. That the fact is the Wall Street protesters, they now own, as far as I'm concerned, the Wall Street protesters, they now own lock, stock, and barrel Wall Street because they bailed out Wall Street. Wall Street did not bail them out, so they now own it.
There
so
you
they
go.
Have a right to protest on their own
there you
holdings.
Go. There you go. And they are we. And we are they. And we have to hold that. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll check in with the Talk Radio News Service right after this and take more of your calls. 45 minutes past the hour. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Victoria Jones on the line with us for the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria, an accredited White House reporter, congressional reporter, Pentagon reporter. You've got so many badges hanging around your neck and so many credits. It's just amazing, Victoria.
My head goes like this.
Yes. And I see that you are in the TalkRadioNews.com luxury suite, also a.k.a. luxury closet. In the basement of the White House, directly underneath where Jay Carney talks. So something must be going on in the White House?
Well, actually, they are away because the president's in Pittsburgh. But
you are the mice who are playing, huh?
The mice who are playing, indeed. But in about 10 minutes' time, Attorney General Eric Holder and FBI Director Mueller are going to make an announcement, which will be that FBI, they are going to say, and DEA agents have disrupted a plot to commit what they're calling a significant terrorist act in the United States tied to Iran. What it is they say the plot included the assassination of the Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States with a bomb and subsequent bomb attacks on the Saudi and Israeli embassies in Washington, D.C.
Whoa.
And the bombings of the Saudi and Israeli embassies in Buenos Aires, Argentina, were also discussed.
Okay, quick question.
Yes.
Is this Iran versus Saudi Arabia, or is this Shia Islam versus Sunni Islam?
Well, this is very, very soon. I mean, this is all I have at the moment. They haven't made the announcement yet. Hard to tell. I mean, the backdrop at the moment really is long-standing tensions between Iran and the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. I mean, just in the last year, Saudi has attempted to build an anti-Iran alliance to sort of push back against what they perceive as aggression by Iran in the region. So, yes, it could be Iran versus Saudi, but it's always Shia and Sunni.
Yeah, amazing. What else is up?
So that announcement will be made. Also, later today, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie will, at an event in New Hampshire, endorse former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney for president.
So Chris Christie, now does this mean that Chris Christie is formally announcing, but is implying that he would love to be vice president? Or is this just his way of saying, I really mean no? Or is this suddenly he's discovered Mitt Romney is the greatest guy in the world?
Well, he thought that Mitt Romney was a great guy for some time.
Okay.
I don't know whether he'd like to be vice president. That would be very interesting.
Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah. My friend Carl Frisch, who's a very, very astute political observer, suggested it's going to be John Thune. But I think, which makes perfect sense to me. But we'll see. We'll see. Anyhow, what else is up?
Well, of course, that does lead me to the presidential debate tonight, which actually is an important one. This one is the first debate on the economy, which is interesting when you consider that there have been a number of presidential debates. This is the first one. At this one, they will be seated at an oval wooden table, not standing at podium. And they will be moderated by some intelligent, thoughtful journalists. I mention that because it's not always the case, so it's newsworthy.
In other words, Fox is not going to moderate this.
It's Bloomberg and the Washington Post. They've got Charlie Rose. they've got Carol Cumulty and Juliana Williams of Bloomberg. So they've got some very thoughtful questions. Charlie Rose does intend to raise the question of Occupy Wall Street and the protests.
Right.
And to ask them about that, as well as other questions on the economy. And many are saying that this is make it or break it for Rick Perry.
Yes.
Because of his lackluster performances. You can have $15 million in the bank, but if you can't perform in a debate...
Yeah, then you're toast, because the big debate is going to come when you're the candidate.
Right.
And a lot of people are backpedaling from him as fast as they can. In fact, there's been questions being raised about his statistics on job creation in Texas, for that matter, now.
Right.
So
it's also going to be an important debate for Herman Cain. I was listening to one of your callers talking about his 999 plan.
Yes.
He is going to be attacked on that today, possibly, among others, by Rick Santorum, who would like to edge him out of the way and try and actually edge himself into the race.
Well, it's easy to attack. I mean, you want to place a 9% sales tax on food for poor people in order to pay for a roughly 26% cut in the income tax of rich people?
Right.
I mean, that's incredible. But my joking comment on it is the same way the Republicans flipped the five-pointed star upside down, turned it from the American flag star to the satanic symbol, you know, in their logo.
Yes.
If you took Herman Cain's 999 and flips it upside down, what do you get? So, anyway,
okay. The president is
moving along.
The president is in Pittsburgh today.
Okay.
Touring the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Training Center, going to deliver remarks. Also meeting his Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, which is today releasing a report. What the Washington Post describes as decrying the human toll of the nation's economic and financial crisis, and the report says if Washington can agree on anything, it should be this, and it should be now. And the report has a lot of things in it that Republicans and Democrats can like and hate, because it basically runs the gamut of different issues. At the same time as it calls for greater spending on infrastructure, it calls for liberalized immigration for qualified workers, calls for attracting $1 trillion in direct foreign investment within five years, training more engineers and healthcare workers, but also further streamlining the patent process, more access to Small Business Administration financing, a more business-friendly tax system, and less restrictive regulation. So you see there's a lot of different things in it that people, some are going to like, some are not going to like, but they say you've got to do all these things in order to free things up for jobs and competitiveness. The president so far, according to his spokesperson, Josh Earnest, is not saying that he will endorse everything in the plan, but we'll look at it very carefully.
Now, this is the Senate plan. This is Harry Reid's new version?
This is the president's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed that key piece there.
Yep.
So, and that's Jeffrey Immelt heads that up, does he not?
That's right.
The head of General Electric.
Yes, that comes out today. And the Senate votes on the president's jobs plan today, and the Democrats may not even get 51 votes.
Yeah, I've been watching that one, too, with some dismay. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. We will be back with David Sirota. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the battle, just a quick heads up, particularly to our listeners in Denver tomorrow night, the Battle of the Talk Show Host, sponsored by AM 760 Colorado's Progressive Talk, which carries this show, along with David Sirota's show, his morning show, will be 7 p.m. at the Comedy Works Landmark Theater in Denver, Colorado. The tickets are sold out. You can enter to win tickets at am760.net. David and I will be there, along with Craig Silverman, Tom Martino, Michael Brown, and more. It is going to be David Sirota. It's going to be you and me against the mob.
It is, but you know, and I think we're up for it.
Yeah, absolutely. David Sirota is with us, the journalist, nationally syndicated weekly newspaper columnist with Salon.com, host of the David Sirota radio show on AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk, and the author of his latest book, Back to the Future, How Our Future How the 1980s explains the world we live in now. I'm sorry, my notes here are all jumbled, David. And davidsirota.com, of course, the website. David, how to stop the political insanity? It's a pretty broad topic, generally speaking, but you wrote a piece recently titled How to Stop the Political Insanity. Recent research shows that turbulent times reward crazy leaders. Here's what we can do to counteract that. Who are the crazy leaders? What's the research, and what do we do?
Yeah, well, the first way to stop the political insanity is admit that we have a problem, and it's not just political, but it's also economic. There were two things that came out recently. One, a book that looked at whether and how turbulent times actually reward politicians who may quite literally be mentally ill. It was a book by a professor at Tufts University trying to look at how we define genuine mental illness and then looking at politicians who have succeeded in turbulent times like now. And basically what this book concludes is that our political system right now is actually rewarding people, promoting people who may be insane.
Right. Now, particularly sociopaths.
Exactly. And now similarly, this is a similar situation on Wall Street. University of St. Gallen in Switzerland conducted a battery of tests comparing the reactions of people working in the financial industry with people who are known psychopaths, people who are in mental institutions because they're psychopaths, and they found that in most cases, those working in the financial sector who they had tested in this series of studies actually were more destructive, both self-destructive and destructive towards others, than known psychopaths. So when we refer to the craziness of the political and economic system right now, we're referring to something that's not metaphorical. We're referring to something that's actually real.
Right. And this is independent of party. This is independent of, right across the board. There have been demagogues on both sides and all sides, frankly. And although I think that over the last decade, I certainly, with my old psychotherapist hat on, would in a heartbeat diagnose George W. Bush as a sociopath or possibly a psychopath, certainly a sociopath. And there's a lot of crossover. And a few others. But I'm curious your thoughts on political movements. How do we, for example, good people who are doing great work with Occupy Wall Street. God bless them. Let's just sit here peacefully and make our presence known. How do you keep out the people that, I'm old enough to remember from the 60s who said, no, let's go burn down that building, or no, let's go occupy that building. In the case of MSU, it was the president's office, and the psychology lab where they were doing the tests, for the Vietnam War, psychological warfare. And that turned into riots that ultimately turned into turning a lot of people off to the movement.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a tough question. I think that there isn't any evidence that the Occupy Wall Street folks are moving in that kind of direction. So I think that it's a tough balancing act. You don't want to respond to people like Mitt Romney who insist that the Occupy Wall Street folks are, quote, dangerous and waging class warfare. But I think the organizers of that movement and everybody who's participating in it need to be well aware that there are things that could be done that would be self-destructive to that movement.
And that frankly, there will be people in the movement who are even their allies who, because of their personality disorders, will cause them to advocate that.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I also think that the way I see our social movement situation right now is I don't think that's nearly as big a potential at this moment, based on what we know about the Occupy Wall Street folks, than perhaps it was many, many years ago. Now, that's not to say that it can't go in that direction, but I sort of put it go from innocent until proven guilty. That's my attitude on this. Protesters who are exercising their First Amendment democratic rights, they are innocent, they are well within their rights until proven that they're not.
Absolutely.
As opposed to what the Republican Party is trying to do right now, which is essentially trying to say that they're guilty, they're automatically going to be lawbreakers or rioters, even though we've seen nothing of the sort.
Right. Although we have seen one right-wing infiltrator who apparently was trying to provoke the police over at the Air and Space Museum over the weekend here in D.C. But we digress. The stopping the political insanity in part also means stopping the time of crisis, which means the crisis we have right now is an economic crisis as well as a war crisis, frankly. So
Absolutely. Your thoughts on
how to stop that?
Yeah, well, it means recognizing that, first of all, as you and I have discussed in the past, social movements are nonpartisan. And I think that it means recognizing when things are crazy, they really are crazy. I mean, last week, the story of the Obama administration setting up a death panel, literally in the White House, this story about Al Awlaki, the American citizen who was killed, and Reuters reporting that there's a group inside the White House operating under no established law, putting people, nominating American citizens to be put on a kill list. I mean, this is the kind of thing that a social movement, even if it more likes Barack Obama than, say, Mitt Romney, cannot be quiet about. It's the same thing with the Occupy Wall Street folks. Instead of looking at the folks who are protesting Wall Street as the supposed crazies, actually, I look at the protests on Wall Street through a different prism. It means looking at them through the prism of they're trying to actually stop the kind of economic psychopathic behavior that has actually driven us into a ditch.
Yeah. In fact, you could say that if you think of, we refer to the body politic, right? And so if you think of the political landscape of a nation as an organism, as a biological organism with a nervous system that responds to stimuli, that when psychopaths take over some aspect of it, in this case Wall Street, and the financial system in general, and the banksters Bernie Sanders points out repeatedly that the six biggest banks in the United States hold assets that are greater than 60%. Five biggest banks hold assets that are greater than 60% of the entire GDP of the United States, the annual GDP of the United States. You know, how crazy is that? I mean, that's genuinely crazy. And then they're running us into a ditch, and they're running the Europeans into a ditch, that there has to be, the organism, in order to survive, has to produce a response. And Occupy Wall Street is part of that response.
That's absolutely right. And I think that it's important that when we define what is crazy and what is not crazy, to understand that typically the traditional media, the Fox Newses of the world, they are trying to basically say that we are all crazy for looking at insanity and calling it for what it is, insane. They're trying to say the danger to the body politic are people who are expressing their grievances, people who are occupying Wall Street, when the entire attitude should be the opposite.
Right.
And as I say in this column that we're referring to, people who are listening to this right now, you are not crazy for thinking the political system is crazy. You are not crazy for thinking that the economy is crazy when we have 30% of corporate profits being generated by a financial sector that doesn't really create or really make anything. That's the insanity. And having a change of perspective to define what we say is acceptable and what we say is insane, that's where we need to be.
Very, very well said. David, I award you an honorary PhD in psychology.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
From Tom Hartman University.
Dr. Sirota.
Okay, Dr. David Sirota. DavidSirota.com. Thank you, David.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oh, me. And David Sirota is one of the best there is. It will be an honor to be standing next to him tomorrow night in Denver. We'll be back.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know how sometimes you know what you know, and sometimes you know what you don't know, and sometimes sometimes, as the Firesign Theater says, everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right.
You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Everything you know is wrong about the movies and politics? Paul Bond is with us. He's a writer and reporter with The Hollywood Reporter. HollywoodReporter.com is the website. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
This THR Penn Schoen-Berlin study shows that Democrats and Republicans like different films and which actors, and there's actually politics in drama?
Oh, sure. Both on the screen and off the screen, Democrats and Republicans both agree that the movies lean left in their liberal messaging. Of course.
Well, I know about off the screen, but I like going to action films. You know, the Bruce Willis kind of movies. It's just like good dumb entertainment. And usually the subtext to these is very George Bushian. You know, it's, you know, find the bad guy who is usually a person of color and torture him and he will give you the information you want. How can it be that the majority of films are left wing when, or am I just like missing them or something?
You're missing them.
Okay, give me some examples
well,
of left-wing films.
You named Die Hard, and that's probably not a good example of a left-wing
movie. Well, it's not just
movie.
Die Hard. I mean, you know, it's, I could give you a long list of them. I mean, it's the Schwarzenegger films, the Terminator films. The only left-wing film that I can think of, or the only one that arguably has a progressive message embedded in it, was James Cameron's movie.
Avatar,
yeah.
Yeah, well, during the poll, we asked, what movie do you think leans most obviously left? And that was the number one film that most moviegoers picked, both Democrats and conservatives, recognized
right,
the left leaning that.
Because the left is, you know, generally pro-environmental, and the right is like, doesn't give a rat's ass about the environment. And then, you know, the military was characterized in a negative fashion in that movie, and the environmentalists, shall we say, were characterized in a positive way.
Oh, sure. And the only good soldier was the soldier that turned against the U.S.
Right. Military. But might that not, couldn't it be that that's the exception of the rule?
No, that is the
exception
rule.
That proves the rule? Okay, so.
No, that is the rule if you want to believe.
Convince me of the rule.
Okay, well, it's 1,000 people. It's a scientific poll. And even Democrats are disagreeing with you. They're saying by about a 60% margin that the messages on screen are left-leaning. And Avatar was number one. Happy Feet was up there. Milk, Cars 2, Twilight, Brokeback Mountain. I mean, these are just some of the titles. That
Brokeback Mountain I can get, you know, because it's like, hey, let's you know, respect everybody in society. It has a message of you know, understanding, you know, our brothers and sisters who are gay, but I don't get, you know, Happy Feet is a left. What was the left wing message of Happy Feet?
Well, again, it was environmentalism. You know, the humans are the bad guys and the penguins are the good guys. And if humans keep behaving like humans, all the penguins will die. That sort of thing.
Isn't there some truth to that, though?
Oh, yeah, but it's perceived as, you know, left wing.
I see.
Don't you think that that's a left wing concern more than a right wing concern?
Well, I don't know. My dad died a Republican, and he was very concerned about the environment. I think that the modern day Republican Party has gone insane, but that's a whole other thing. What were the right wing movies?
The movies that were named as being right wing: The Incredibles, you know, the Disney movie.
Mm-hmm.
Fireproof,
right.
Which was a Christian movie. 300, The Pursuit of Happiness.
I haven't seen any of these movies. I guess that proves
that.
Proves the point. Well, I see very few movies, but, you know, maybe four or five a year. But
here's one that you probably saw, Lord of the Rings. Did you see that series?
Actually, I saw one of them.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought it was just, you know, I thought it was overdone and slow.
Oh, okay.
But I read the books, and you know, with that kind of movie, it's like if you've read Tolkien, there's no movie that'll ever capture the brilliance of his prose.
Right, right. And there are movies.
But that was perceived as a right-wing movie?
It's perceived as a right-wing movie, yeah.
Why?
You know, I didn't delve into that one because it was pretty low on the list.
Uh-huh.
But other ones that were higher on the list were, it was more obvious that right-wingers liked them more than left-wingers or vice versa, were movies like Soul Surfer, Secretariat, Braveheart. Those all appealed to right-wingers. Whereas the left-wing...
I thought Braveheart was a fine movie. I don't get what's right-wing about it. It was actually a Challenge Authority movie, which seems to be a left-wing message.
Yeah, well, it also appealed to Republicans a lot more than Democrats.
The idea of an insurgency taking on an established government appeals to Republicans?
Oh, yeah.
Was it just that it was Mel Gibson and you know, he's like crazy for the right?
No, the right wing isn't enamored with Mel Gibson.
Not since he opened his big mouth when he was drunk, but, you know, before that, I think everybody, you know, we'd all heard from his father. We kind of knew where he was. Wink, wink, nod, nod.
Yeah. No, well, it's the inspirational aspect of the movie that the right-wingers embrace and, you know, the whole message of freedom. And left-wingers didn't put that as high on their list as they did, The Departed, American Beauty, Crash. They like these edgier,
Did True Lies show up on any of these? I guess that's too old. True Lies and Blazing Saddles. Some of the I think of as just absolutely classic movies from the modern era.
No, those would be movies that appealed to both parties almost equally.
Really?
Yeah.
That's interesting, because I would say Blazing Saddles, you know, might even have a left wing. It certainly has a racial tolerance message to it. A very strong one.
Well, what are you saying? Republicans aren't racially tolerant?
Yeah, I'd say that.
I know a lot of Republicans that would disagree with you, even in Hollywood.
I'm sure. And you know, God bless them if they would disagree with that. But, you know, there's, in any case, Paul
well,
Bond.
Well, look at Pursuit of Happiness. I mean,
yeah, I didn't see the movie, so I can't comment.
Oh, okay.
HollywoodReporter.com is the website. Paul Bond is the author of the fascinating. Paul, thanks for being with us.
Hey, no problem. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, The Good, the Bad, and the Insanely Ugly, and your favorite movies? So much other. There's a lot to talk about. We'll be right back. That would be The Good, the Bad, and the Very, Very Dysgenically Ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The Good, National People's Action, the organization descended upon Chicago this weekend to protest the Mortgage Bankers Association's annual conference. About 40 protesters took to kayaks and paddled up the Chicago River dressed in Robin Hood costumes. When they breached the Michigan Bridge, they put up a banner that read, Wall Street steals from the 99, gives to the rich. Let's take it back. And more protests are expected today at the conference. Keep up the good work, people. The bad. The Seattle Police Department. At Occupy movements across the nation, it's become the custom for drivers on the road to honk their horns in support of the camped-out demonstrators. Well, Seattle police are clamping down on that by ticketing drivers now who honk. One cabbie was even given a $144 ticket for doing so. At some point, the police will understand that the 99% movement includes them. The kids are on the street trying to protect the jobs of police officers from the 1% who'd rather hire Blackwater to do all the police work. And the very, very ugly Fox News talking head, Monica Crowley. Piling on with others at Fox so-called News, Crowley went after the Occupy Wall Street demonstrators, calling them, quote, useful idiots who probably haven't paid much in taxes their whole life, end quote. Right. Just like GE and the rest of the corporate giants who not only pay no taxes, they get tax rebates. Crowley and the rest of the gang at Fox so-called News have made it pretty clear in recent weeks that when it comes down to siding with the 99 or the 1%, they side with the 1%. Fox News for billionaires. That's very, very ugly. So let's pick up some of your phone calls. Tim in Henderson, North Carolina. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. Tim, how about you?
I'm doing all right. It's a rain day, so I got a chance to watch you.
Okay.
I'm sorry I got hung up earlier. I guess cell phone ignorant.
It's okay. What's up?
Things over. You've hit on so many different things. I think the movie thing, you know, why everything's labeled a certain way is there's been a real run-up for right-wing, you know, how do you call it, left-wing media bias, left-wing this bias,
sure.
Left-wing that bias.
Yeah.
And they've actually sold it. I mean, the last poll I saw had Ronald Reagan as the second greatest president.
I know. I know. That's because of the Reagan Legacy Project. They actually got several hundred million dollars to fund a program, a multi-decade program, to make sure that every county in America has at least one building named after Ronald Reagan. And they're very close to finally accomplishing their goal, and that causes kids, I mean, little kids, they look around, they go, oh, yeah, there's the Washington Monument, and there's the Lincoln stuff, and there's the Reagan stuff. Reagan must have been like those guys. Yeah, you know,
well,
I think he was one of the worst presidents, but...
I don't think he was one of the worst presidents either, but I ran contra. I mean, you know, if that would have been during a time of war, that's called treason.
Yeah.
That's beside the point. It's amazing the selling that has happened and people have bought into it. I'm trying to, like, I hosted a tea party back when, you know, we were trying to get out of the wars, trying to stop the bailouts and all those other things. It quickly got corrupted. I mean,
yeah.
Tea party's nothing like it was.
Yeah.
Now I see a new movement coming out and I host a radio program myself. And I mean, I get attacked every time I mention, the Wall Street. Occupy Wall Street, and I said, well, this is more Tea Party-like.
Yeah.
The Tea Party Boston Tea Party was about a corporation forcing people to sign on to that corporation to sell tea.
Yeah, to the extent, yeah, the original Tea Party was a revolt against the British East India Company, and it was because they had just gotten a massive tax cut, which was the Tea Act of 1773. Look it up. It was a tax cut for the British East India Company that saved them millions and millions of dollars so that they could undercut the price of tea brought into the United, into what we call the United States, into the colonies, by small entrepreneurs. They could put the small entrepreneurs out of business because there were tens of thousands of little tea shops up and down the East Coast, and the East India Company wanted to completely dominate that business. And when they got this huge tea cut with the Tea Act of 1773, it was the local entrepreneurs, basically, and the people who supported them who threw the tea in the harbor, and they were saying enough already. And so you were a tea partier who thought, you know, the bank bailouts are no good, this stinks, and now you're looking at the 99% movement who are saying the same thing, and you're saying they're one and the same, but your old Tea Party friends are saying, no, wait a minute, they're different?
Well, the Tea Party has, the ones who left the Tea Party with me are all on board.
Yeah.
It's the Tea Party that basically came out. I mean, we had like 200 people there, and one of the first things I said was, we've needed to do this for 30 years.
Yeah.
And I could see people thinking in their head, and it was like he could have heard a cricket chirp.
Huh.
No one agreed with that. But these are things that have needed to happen. I mean,
yes.
Violence, of course, doesn't need to happen. But
no.
We've needed to do this for a long time. I want the Democratic side or whatever. I mean, the side that's not the right wing.
Right.
To finally get some backbone and stand up for yourselves.
Yeah. Stand up and stand. In other words, the populace, the people, we the people. Stand
the people.
Up and speak out.
99%. Yeah.
There you go.
Stand up.
Okay. Well said. Tim, great to hear from an XT partier. Thank you very much for calling into the show. Much appreciated. Walt in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Walt, what's up?
Not much. I'm interested in your opinion on how we can achieve campaign finance reform and when.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have an opinion on that?
It's going to take an amendment to the Constitution or a change in the composition of the Supreme Court. And the change in the composition of the Supreme Court would have to be in a leftward direction rather than a rightward direction. So either we amend the Constitution to say corporations aren't people and money isn't speech. And there are, you know, a variety of different efforts to do that. My favorite one is at movetoamend.org. There's another one Dylan Radigan has championed, getmoneyout.com, I think is his website. There are others. I honor them all, although Dylan Radigan's is focused purely on campaign finance reform. I think if we're going to amend the Constitution, we should take away corporate power as well and say corporations aren't people. That would do away with their ability to participate in politics. But until we do that, and then the changing the composition of the Supreme Court, a very high probability in the next 5 years, you've got Justice Kennedy, who is in his mid to late 70s. You've got, there are several members of the court who are in their 70s who may well retire over the next couple of years. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I would put that at a very, very high probability. She's been sick. If she was replaced with a right winger, in other words, if Mitt Romney gets elected president, the court will become even more hard right, and it'll be even harder to get campaign finance reform. If Barack Obama is elected president, whether you love or hate his policies with regard to drones or Iraq or whatever, he will appoint good people to the Supreme Court, and probably they would revisit the Citizens United case and roll it back. And but as long as you've got five right wingers controlling the Supreme Court, three of whom are in their 70s, I believe. Certainly Kennedy is, Scalia is, and, I'm not sure how old Thomas is. He might be in his late 60s, but in any case, those are my two hopes, Walt, is one, you know, amend the Supreme Court, and you can talk to your legislators about, amend the Constitution, talk to your legislators about that, and two, make sure we have a Democrat in the White House the next time a Supreme Court nominee, an opening comes up. David in St. Paul. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, hey Tom. In regards to this guy from the American Spectator, Patrick Hawley, who went in and kind of instigated this pepper spraying of these protesters at the Smithsonian or wherever it was.
Yeah.
If that would have been an anarchist at a Tea Party rally doing that, wouldn't they be? And they went back and bragged about it online. Wouldn't they be arrested for inciting a riot or something? I mean, before the Republican convention in St. Paul here in 2008, we had people that were preemptively arrested.
Yes.
For,
for simply planning demonstrations. Yes.
For simply, you know, planning the demonstrations. They were called the Anti-War Committee, and yeah. So here you have a guy actually inciting something, bragging about it online, and nothing's been done about investigating this.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you, David. Excellent point. And, you know, had this happened on the other side, you know, what would have come of that? Boy. Jason in D.C., Washington, D.C. Hey, Jason, what's up?
Hey, I was just going to comment. You know, a lot of these people are all upset with the banks and so forth like that. They're just getting upset, really, with the Indians. The general behind all this is the Federal Reserve. I mean, the dollar's lost over 50% of its purchasing power over the last 10 years. That's robbery from everybody. That means I got to pay 100% more for gas, 100% more for wheat, 100% for everything that I would have 10 years ago.
Well, it's not everything.
It's a good amount of it. If the dollar uses 50% of its purchasing power, what am I going to do if every commodity is priced in dollars?
Right.
So the thing is, Joe, all these people are out there, and they're missing the forest for the trees sort of idea. It's the Fed. It's the Fed's manipulation of the money system. Because the people that are hurt the most from manipulation of money are the people that are at the bottom of the economic ladder.
Yeah, I'm with you. I've been from day one on this program saying that the Fed should be nationalized.
And I'm actually with
Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson's old foe, on this issue.
It's such a scary thing, though, because, you know, at the end of the day, it's a big distraction, and nobody's sitting there. I haven't seen a single person, you know, start worrying about this. And about both parties. Look, Barack Obama got $16 million. From Wall Street people, you know. He got twice as much as George W. Bush. If you look at the list of all of the money that's been donated, both parties, both are in the pockets of Wall Street, and they give the money equally. It's like 45, you know.
Well, actually, they're not giving it equally. They gave, in the last election cycle, Wall Street, big Wall Street players, gave more money to Barack Obama than they did to John McCain. So far, they're giving more than 80% of it. There was an article about it in the New York Times a week or so ago, more than 80% of their money to Mitt Romney. In fact, the Romney campaign's single largest source of money has been Wall Street. So I think that the winds are changing, and that they do, to some extent, have the ability to pick winners or losers, which has to be causing President Obama to stay up at nights, you know, wake him up in the middle of the night. Or maybe not. I don't know. But it's, again, if you want to pick a victim or a villain for that, it is five guys in black robes right down the street from here who said these are the rules of the game. And that needs
to
change.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with your calls right after this, 45 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman Program.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, and Jackie in Spring, Texas. Hey, Jackie, what's up?
You have so many that you've had on here that were so interesting, but what I was going to come back to was the three free trade acts that are in the jobs bill.
Yes.
And I had called my rep last week on it to please vote against that if this was voted separately, because it just makes for outsourcing unless they put tariffs in there or such, outsourcing jobs. And so this week when I heard what Senator Reid was doing, I called, and I didn't get much of an answer, but they're going to be voting on it. But I had called Pelosi's office, and I said I'd like them to turn down the three free trade acts.
Right.
And the aide said, yes, okay. I said, well, I'd like to tell you why. He said, we know. He said, we're on it.
Oh, yeah. They absolutely know why. Here's the problem. I mean, you know, sometimes you have to take sometimes your medicine tastes bitter, you know what I mean? And for whatever reason, the administration, the White House, and probably, if not a majority, a significant minority of the Democratic Party, and certainly the majority of the Republican Party, are in favor of these three free trade acts, South Korea, Colombia, and Panama. And, of course, it's because the big banksters and the big transnational corporations want them, particularly Panama, because Panama's principal business is not manufacturing. It's secret banking, which would establish a Liechtenstein or a Monaco or a, you know, you fill in the blank, one of those, a Switzerland, basically, in the Western Hemisphere. And I'm totally opposed to them, but you're right. Harry Reid made it so that you can't amend this thing, so it's going to be all or nothing. And frankly, if we get a good jobs bill and we get those three free trade agreements, that's better for me than no jobs bill. You know, as much as I would like to be a purist, I think eventually the whole free trade thing is going to collapse under its own weight. It's insane. It doesn't work. And people have figured it out.
The problem with it, it's not just going to hurt our country. It's going to hurt those other countries.
They want
those other countries to accept our genetically modified foods. They don't want them.
Yeah, and for Colombia, you know, it's the corn and whatnot. Yeah, this is the problem with NAFTA. Excellent point, Jackie. Thank you so much for calling and making it. Nate in Minneapolis. Hey, Nate, what's up?
Oh, wow, I'm on the Tom Hartman program. Man, I want to thank you for taking my call. I love watching you on Free Speech TV, man. Every day is an education with you.
Thank you.
I just want to throw that out there.
What's up?
Hey, man, I worked in comic book stores a long time, you know, part-time job as a kid, still a big comic book aficionado. And I want to turn this into the Koch brothers, and I need your wisdom on this, OG. Man, Marvel Comics had something called Dark Reign, in which basically the big villains of the comic book, you know, genre took over, you know, America. We're able to run the heroes to the hills and take over. And I think you know where I'm going here. I think you see this one playing out. When did the Koch brothers pull this nonsense off that they've pulled off on us? And that's where, you know, kind of I'm taking it. You know, Spider-Man's arch nemesis, the Green Goblin, Norman Osborn, became the chairman of Homeland Security. And so, you know, and I'm seeing this now, all of these horrid characters that ran, you know, even moderate Republicans to the hills, to, you know, they literally just ran them off, you know, and put these Tea Party tantrum throwers in here. When did this happen, or when did they begin to, you know, to set this stuff in motion? And, you know, I just kind of wanted to touch on your wisdom about that, because you're the guy, you know, I'd heard of the Koch brothers, and I know they're refinery owners, and are they worth $21 billion each, or do they split that fortune?
I think it's almost twice that now. I think that they've seen their income or their assets almost doubled during the last decade. But
I see. Now we don't have to ask why, do we?
I'm not the expert on the Koch brothers. Robert Greenwald just has done a documentary. You can see it at bravenewfilms.org. And you know, he was on our show earlier about this. But when I was 13 years old in 64 and was going door to door for Barry Goldwater, my dad took me to a John Birch Society meeting. And the John Birch Society was funded by Fred Koch and co-founded by Fred Koch, who is the father of Charles and David Koch. And the John Birch Society, I mean, they also were one of the sponsors of CPAC last year with a conservative political action committee, or conference rather, that I do my show from every year, or have for the last 5 years. But they're still around, but they're kind of marginalized. So I would submit to you that the Koch children, you know, Charles and David, that they have kind of reinvented the John Birch Society under a new name, the Tea Party, and ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They've done it in a far more subtle, far more sophisticated, and frankly, much more well-funded way. Their father was, you know, kind of clumsy about it and not that much of a political sophisticate. So that's my take on it, Nate. I may well be wrong, but that's my take on it. Nate, I got only 1 minute left. I want to get another caller in. Thank you for the call, though. Great to hear from you. Curtis in Thief River Falls, Minnesota. Hey, Curtis, what's up?
First of all, I want to plug your sponsor, Edison Factor. I'm 75 years old. I was losing my short-term memory. It's gotten very, very short. I just want anybody out there that has brain problems, memory problems, it works.
I am drinking it right now, although I only take a half a scoop a day. I don't take the two scoops they recommend. I think that's too much for me.
I agree. I get along on 2 teaspoons rather than 2 tablespoons.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, what's up?
Okay. And next of all, I called my Congressman Colin Peterson last week and said, what are you doing to support the 99ers? He said, we are not even discussing it.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, this has been going on for 3 weeks, and you haven't discussed it? He says, yeah, that's right.
Now, is he a Democrat or Republican?
Republican.
Yeah.
Colin Peterson of Minnesota.
Of course, yeah. And so, I mean, that's the kind of bizarre tragedy is that there seems to be this partisan, you know, the 99ers are Democrats, the Tea Partiers are Republicans. I think they're both populist movements, at least for the people who are showing up. You know, at the level of leadership, there might be some partisanship, but and particularly with the Tea Party. Curtis, thank you very much for the call. I'll be back Thursday with Tales of How David Sirota and I took on the entire city of Denver conservative talk radio hosts' infrastructure and survived, hopefully. The lefties will prevail. Carl Frisch will be here tomorrow. Please give him a warm welcome. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Well, we'll see you the day after.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.